Hello there. And we are live. Hello again there, everybody. There's the awkward bit, which I didn't stop. Well, welcome back to another Morgoth's Endeavor's classic movies. And today we're looking at the Deer Hunter, which is a gloomy 70s classic. Comes in right at the end of the 70s. And it's about, well, we'll get into that in a minute. I mean, hello, Endeavor. How are you keeping?
I'm not bad. Thanks for having me back on, and I always enjoy these streams. Looking forward
Yeah,
to it.
me too. So the someone in the chat says hello, folks. So yeah, I think I chose the Deer Hunter because I was on a stream a few weeks ago, and I was with Frodi Midjord for the Guide to Kultur, is it? If you want to be posh. And I was talking about First Blood, and I thought I was kind of confused about what I should do for this our next classic movies, because I just did a movie all about like a video all about 80s dystopias, which was actually the plan. And I thought, well, I think I'm going to sort of do a sort of sequel stream to the First Blood one, and this time it'll be Deer Hunter, because I feel like Deer Hunter is almost set in the same universe as First Blood, but definitely not the other Rambo movies, obviously, because it's got that really like authentic, realistic feel and look to it. We're back in the mountains again. It's Vietnam veterans, and it's got similar things. Small town America, though on a different side of the country. And I mean, I think most people will be familiar with the story. It's a working class steel mill town in Pennsylvania, and they're Russian Orthodox. I used to think they were Latvian or something, or Polish maybe, but they're Russians. Like, they're Americans, but they're descended from Russians, and they've got their own community there. And it's beautiful the way they've done it, because it's not like idealized and sort of overly romanticized. It is a grotty town, and like Stan, one of the men's a bit of a dick. You know, they're not perfect people. It's realistic. And then there's a the big scene which people are already like talking about in the chats. This huge start off scene, which is the wedding, and then them being sent off to Vietnam, sort of a goodbye party. And then the second part of the movie is the war itself. They get captured. They seem to have been split up, and they sort of meet up again in Vietnam in the jungle, and then they get caught, and then they've got the Russian roulette scene, which is really famous and controversial. And then you enter into the third part, and it's back picking up the pieces from what's happened. So all of these different things we can get into. I mean, it's really got a strict three act structure to the whole film. And the third one goes on and on for a long time, which is kind of why it's more of a character study than something political. So I think that's where we to kind of get into it. There's you obviously got the opening wedding scene, and the friendship between Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, it's Michael and Nikki. You've also got John Savage, I think he's called. And John Cazale, who was a great actor of the 70s, who died. I think this was his last movie, or there may have been another one he did with Al Pacino. I'm not sure of the date. So that's kind of where we are. What were your impressions of The Deer Hunter and Endeavor?
Well, it was actually a really good movie. It was the first time I ever saw it about a week or two ago, surprisingly. I had heard of it before, but I just never had never got around to watching it. I must say that it has a lot of a mixture of emotions in it. I mean, it's a very sad movie, definitely. But then also, there is a lot of feel good. There's a lot of feel good things about like the town. It's very homely. Oh, I'm getting a bit of feedback. I'm hearing myself speak.
There's a lot of feel good things about like the
Sorry,
town.
one second.
Very homely.
Could you try muting yourself for a second? Oh,
Yeah,
okay.
I had Entropy open. I've just closed Entropy.
Okay, yeah. So what I was saying, so there's a lot of interesting themes like the theme of homeland. They're really not idealized, but you know, somewhat wholesome and somewhat authentic American town in small town rural Pennsylvania in the 70s. And yeah, you know, it goes through a lot of different emotions, and it says a lot about masculinity, about patriotism, war, and then, you know, there's the famous theme of Russian roulette, which of course is controversial. One thing that's interesting is I actually speak Russian, and I could understand what they were saying to each other in a few of the scenes when the old ladies are like crying to the priest or things like that. I thought that was interesting. You know, I think that one thing people often forget about American history is that a lot of America was covered with ethnic enclaves throughout the first, you know, century or two of its existence. And I'm guessing that this town would have been a remnant of that. So I think they all of them were born in America, but they would have been the descendants of Russian immigrants. You get that in places like Minnesota as well. There's lots of Swedish. There's lots of Swedish settlers in Minnesota. It's easy to forget that a huge amount of America was settled by Germans, places like Texas or the Midwest. And yeah, you know, I really like the opening act of, you know, them working in the steel mill, then having their wedding celebration and drinking and then going hunting and stuff. You know, I think, you know, the 70s is not my favorite era. I'm more of a 20s, 30s and 40s kind of guy. But at the same time, you know, when you look back at it, it actually does look pretty good. You kind of do wish that you could just, you know, work a 8-hour shift in a steel mill, then you'd come home and you'd have a wife and a beer in the fridge, and then you can go out hunting with your buddies on the weekend and then watch American football at the bar. It's interesting that they were in Pennsylvania. When I used to watch American football, I quit. My favorite team was the Steelers, and they all like the Steelers as well. So, yeah, I definitely like the theme of homeland and the setting of the small town.
Yeah, I mean, when I used to watch it when I was younger, I used to hate the opening. In fact, I used to often avoid watching the Deer Hunter because it's like you think, oh, God, there's about an hour of dancing and drinking and then like wandering around in the woods at the beginning. And I was like, oh, can we just get to the war? Like, what kind of war movie is this? And of course, what he's doing, I mean, it should be like just on a side note here. The director of Michael Cimino, he really does seem like a bit of an oddball. If you look at his Wikipedia page, he seems to be a funny character. He's dead now, but he also made the legendary Heaven's Gate, which was like nearly sunk Hollywood or something. It was like a notoriously terrible movie, which if you look back now, probably isn't that bad. But yeah, I used to dread the Deer Hunter because of the wedding stuff at the start, because it just dragged on and on and on. But what he's doing is establishing the characters and making you feel at home. So you see them in their normal lives. You see them going out drinking. You see them at work in the steel mill, and it's a genuine, like, proper community. They walk into the shop and everybody knows everybody, and it's really nice to see. And again, it is a bit run down, and you can see that it's poor, but it's a community with genuine heart. And so when you look at it from today's perspective, you've got to be careful because it isn't that great, but it does have like a realness to it that I really like. But what he's doing is when they eventually go off to Vietnam. And it is, and eventually, you've got a few things happening because Robert De Niro is kind of more alpha and a bit more confident, a bit more where he's different to the rest of the men. And in many ways, Nicky is kind of the opposite. Robert De Niro's character, Michael, he seems to have a sort of Nietzschean kind of mentality. He's got this whole thing like with one shot. And people were saying, like, well, what does that mean? What is he getting at by that one-shot thing? And I think it comes down to a sort of kill or be killed attitude. And Nicky's, like, much more of a romantic. He's much more open-hearted and soft. But the thing is, when they're in normal, like, their normal life in Pennsylvania, it means that De Niro comes across as a bit of a weirdo, and people think he's a bit cracked, or you know, he doesn't fit in. Whereas somebody like Nicky does, and the other ones do. But then when they're wrenched out of their comfort zone and they go into the jungle, they go to Vietnam, you can see that Robert De Niro comes into his own, and he has to kind of bail out the other ones. But even then, it's as if he sees them, the other one, Fred, Stevie, he's called. I was searching for the name. Stevie is a bit knackered. And you can see it again where he says to Nicky, like, I think we're just going to have to leave him. I think we're going to have to leave him to die. He's because he's got this really tough mentality, which comes into its own in Vietnam, which Nicky's doesn't fare so well, as I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah, what you see with the group of men is that they all kind of, everyone who's had a group of buddies when they were young, they always have this one guy who's like the alpha, the head of the pack. Then you'll probably have the beta also. And then maybe, you know, the guy who's kind of maybe a bit awkward. I can't remember what was the guy's name, the guy who worked at the bar, like the chubby guy with the bad knees. He didn't go to Vietnam.
Yeah, I forgot his name. Is the actor's George Dunza.
Mm-hmm, yeah. But you know, a lot of times when you have a group of mates when you're young, you kind of know each of these different roles. So, for example, Stanley, he's the beta. I mean, and it's actually really interesting what they do with him later in the movie. But he's really physically small. He has a high-pitched voice, and he's desperate for the attention of women. And he's always carrying around this little revolver. And, you know, that's really interesting, this theme of him always carrying around this little revolver with and you know, you see later in the film how what's his name, Michael, Robert De Niro's character, how he scolds him and, you know, actually nearly kills him, because, you know, he's carrying around this little revolver just so that he can feel powerful. He knows that he's not someone who's physically strong, and not somebody who's like has a strong personality. He doesn't have the alpha vibes at all. He's really thirsty, as we say, and he doesn't go off to Vietnam. So, you know, when Michael comes back and he's experienced all that, he really sees someone as like Stanley as being like really pathetic, almost like a child running around with a pair of scissors, not knowing the danger that he poses.
Yeah, it's exactly. I mean, we've all known this is the like it's an interesting thing because we've all known this sort of archetypes which are in the deer hunter. I grew up with, you know, with a lot of lads. But I have to say, like, the Stan archetype was like, that was the most common in the Northeast when I grew up in the 90s, where you've got, like, this little whipshit who thinks he's more than he is, and he's always running his mouth off. And it's, I mean, you know, I know it's going to anger people, but when people are talking about violent and bloody revolutions on the internet, I always think it's going to be the Stan type that's behind the avatar. You know, with his little pistol that he's never actually going to shoot anybody with, and all of this, he is a certain kind of man. Is the Stan archetype, and you get the more sensitive ones as well. And I do think that De Niro comes across as a bit weird. I mean, in the first part of it, there's a bit where he says he's pointing up at the moon. And he has this, I think it's like some sort of like native Indian like mysticism about it being the sun dogs or something. And Stan's just like, what are you talking about? You're full of shit. What are you coming out with this crap for all the time? So De Niro's trying to have this kind of more mystical and poetic vision, you know, and he's just shot down by it. He's just like, what are you talking about? It's a load of shit. It's like always just like the dumb grug take from Stan, you know what I mean? You do come across these kinds all the time.
I also like the scene where they go hunting the first time before they ship off to Vietnam, and Stan forgets his boots. The first thing he does is he blames everyone else. He says somebody else must have taken his boots, or that something weird has happened. One of the guys stole them, or one of the guys threw them out of the car. When really he just didn't bring them because he was unprepared. And then he says to Michael, let me borrow your spare boots. And Michael just says, no, you can't. You got to learn every time you come up here, your head's up your ass. With like the Stan character. And I also want to say that I don't think he's like a bad guy. I don't think he's a villain or anything. He's still part of the group. He's still one of the guys. And I'm sure that, you know, they probably saw him as a brother like the rest of them. But, you know, he has an archetype, which he's not really masculine. He's not the kind of guy that you could have as a leader. He's not really prepared for the harsh realities of the world.
Yeah, he's a mooch. He can only really exist because he's got the stronger ones, like, sort of bailing him out all the time. I mean, so the scene, I mean, it's beautiful the way they've shot the mountains as well. I mean, we'll come onto more of that later. But the bit with the boots where he doesn't have his boots, and you'll see in that scene that they all turn up and they're still wearing their tuxedos. And De Niro is the only one with dressed to hunt, dressed for business. And the rest of them are still like drinking beer, while they're wearing their tuxedo suits from the wedding the night before. And even like in his normal, like, sort of day-to-day life, you can see that Stan hangs around with like that big fat degenerate one. So he's like twice his size. And it's just like a certain archetypes of men which you've all come across. And I do like that. I do think it does a very good job of that.
Yeah, so Axel is kind of the big fat guy, is kind of the quiet one of the group. Whereas I think, what was the other guy's name? John, the fat guy who works at the restaurant. I think his name was John. He's like the clown, kind of the funny one, the one who's full of life and of joy. I love the scene where Axel puts mustard on the Twinkie, and then John just yells out, "That's mustard!" You know, because you just have all those kind of moments with your buddies when you're young. You know, you'll get the one who's kind of like a bit awkward and quiet, and he does something weird, and then the clown guy, you know, he's always the one to you know, act like a bit of a klutz. So yeah, you know, the director definitely knows, he definitely knows men. He definitely knows how men act and how they act in groups. And, you know, I think that the movie also says a lot about the relationship that men have with each other, because there's several scenes where Stan calls Michael a homosexual. There are several people who have interpreted the movie as Michael actually was in love with what's his name? Nick, like, sexually, but I don't think that's actually the case. I think it actually is like the movie is about kind of the natural bond that men share with each other. And, you know, that one thing that they've done with that a lot of liberal critics have done over the years is that they've tried to assign homosexuality to that. And that kind of undermines the masculine archetype, because saying that that kind of bond must be sexual. I know a lot of them have said that about Lord of the Rings or Withnail and I, and a lot of them said that about The Deer Hunter, but I don't think that's the case. I think you can actually have like these deep masculine bonds that aren't in any way, shape, or form sexual.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when they eventually do go to Vietnam, that's also a controversial part of the movie, because people were saying that it's racist the way they've depicted the Vietnamese, that Russian roulette didn't happen, and all of these kinds of things. And it is like famously savage. That whole scene is like absolutely brutal. And I think, what do you make of that? What do you think about how the Vietnamese are portrayed in this?
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to add before that is I thought that the transition from the small town to Vietnam was perfect, because what I was expecting when I saw this movie, I was expecting like a scene where they all like hug their family members goodbye, and then they get on a plane, and then they get off, and there's some drill sergeant like saying, "Welcome to Vietnam, boys, you're not in Kansas anymore," or something like that. But what it does is it's like a complete break. So you just go straight from them. I think they were like drinking at the bar together after hunting. It just goes straight there to Michael's in the middle of a field, and he just torches a Viet Cong. You know, people are being killed. Everything's on fire. They end up getting captured. So it's just like a complete break. And what that does so well is that it shows the contrast between small town USA and Vietnam. You know, so the Vietnamese are, of course, portrayed as being ruthless and cruel. But, you know, I don't think that that's – and, yeah, so that a lot of people will point out that Russian roulette was never actually played in Vietnam. And that's a fair criticism. But, you know, I have to imagine, though, for a American guy from small town USA in the 60s and 70s, being put in Vietnam was probably it was absolutely shocking. I mean, he was being put in a completely different world. And I think the point that it's trying to get by is that this is something that is fundamentally foreign to the world that they come from. It's easy. There's the saying that a fish who swims in water doesn't know that water exists. It's easy for people, especially the more isolated you are from the outside world, it's easier for people to think that their way of life is just the human norm. And especially this is something that a lot of people in the West today, and it's coming back to bite us, but we tend to think that our way of life is the norm around the world, and that it always can be like that. And what the film really drives home is that no, this is not how life really is outside of America, outside of in places like Vietnam, these countries, it's much more brutal, and it's, the contrast is just night and day.
Yeah, and the way they do that is that they're all jumping around being a bunch of drunken morons in the wedding, and they go to the bar, and you see somebody who's actually been to Vietnam, and he's standing there, and he's completely different to the rest of them. He's just like, it's as if he's been like hollowed out. And Michael De Niro's character, he is the most sort of based. He's the most unlike De Niro in real life. I mean, good God, just as a quick aside again, like, there is a problem when you become this kind of lib shit, this total fanny the way De Niro has in his old age, where he's going on like Saturday Night Live and complaining about Donald Trump's tweets and all of this. Like, it really does affect how you look at him in all of his old movies. Like, I wish they could just shut their mouths so that at least their old movies, which are decent, at least we can cling on to them, because they do. It does have an effect. I was thinking of how he's turned out while I was watching the movie. Why couldn't he just be quiet, you know?
I was thinking the exact same thing. You know, I was going to say this for a bit later, but what I wanted to say was that, I think that character people like, and same with Meryl Streep, she's a horrible shit lib in real life too. You know, I feel like the characters they're portraying in small town USA, they're portraying the best of America in the movie, but in real life, they're actually these Hollywood liberals who, look down and really hate the people, this kind of people from these small towns. They really are the worst of America in real life, but. Sorry, like, I didn't want to detract from what we were talking
about. It's like someone in the chat says, like, the bloke who, the soldier who comes into the pub's got the 1,000-year stare. And that's kind of like how I was looking at De Niro through this, just thinking about how much of a shit labor he is. Now, I was given the television that look that the soldier gives them in the bar. But anyway, so you can see that he's seen things that they haven't. And he kind of looks at them with contempt because they don't know what they're in for. They're just like lambs to the slaughter, but they don't know it. And I think De Niro kind of gets it. He kind of thinks that there's something not right here. And then it's just a couple of scenes later, and he's got like a flamethrower, and they're in the blood and guts of it in Vietnam. And it's really quite shocking, especially the bit where there's loads of women and children in like a bunker thing. And one of the North, like, so they'll be the South Vietnamese. And then a Northern soldier just lifts it up and tosses a hand grenade in and blows them all to hell. And it's really, the way they shoot the pig as well. Like, it's really savage as soon as you get to Vietnam, like you were saying, there's none of this kind of arsing around with the drill sergeant or anything. It just drops. Like, they've obviously been through all of that, but we skip all of that. I mean, I think it's important to remember of all the Vietnam War movies as well. This was like one of the very first ones that took it seriously. There was a couple of sort of patriotic flag waving things, like the Green Berets with John Wayne, but the Oliver Stone kind of. Like Quentin Tarantino did a piss take in True Romance, where he had this movie within a movie which was called Coming Home in a Body Bag. So there was this whole genre of Hollywood movies that came out in the 80s, which were all about Vietnam, and the Tarantino's like sort of parody was to call them Coming Home in a Body Bag, because they all had a sort of similar message about Vietnam. And so I think it's fair to say that. Like, the Deer Hunter is the first of the Coming Home in a Body Bag kind of Vietnam genre, but it's also like the least critical of them.
Yeah, I haven't seen that many. The only other one I can think of off the top of my head is Apocalypse Now, which is also another interesting movie. But I guess one thing we could get onto though is the theme of the war. So because Vietnam, of course, it's been always been political. It was hugely political back in the day, and you know, it's still political to this day. You know, I have to say that it probably is the best anti-war movie I've seen, at least ones that are set in this era. I know there's lots of great anti-war movies, but what's really interesting is my interpretation is it's an anti-war movie, but the anti-war movement of the era is associated with the left. There's the famous idea that, oh, these hippies protesting the Vietnam War with their John Lennon sunglasses and their flowers on their shirts or something like that. But this one, it really comes at it from a lot more of a paleo-conservative angle, kind of like the two things I imagined would either be it's kind of like a Pat Buchanan angle, or maybe a pre-World War II American isolationist interpretation of it. That it's not saying that, like, the message of the left is that, oh, America is this horrible imperialist empire going off oppressing the yellow man on the other side of the world with his war, and, you know, they went there and killed innocent people and stuff like that. And I think that what I got from Deer Hunter is saying that it's not saying that Americans are these evil imperialists going off to conquer the poor Vietnamese, but rather that America is, like, generally a good thing. Like, their town, it's not perfect by any stretch, but it is something that overall is good. And that, you know, the working class guy in Pennsylvania who's in his spot in the world doesn't need to go off to some foreign shithole country and fight a war that really has no effect on him in his home. And the real critique is, well, why are we going off and fighting this war on the other side of the world when our place in the world is here?
Yeah, if anything, that's what's in it. But it's definitely the least, I think it's the least overtly political of all of the kind of Vietnam War movies, so especially the Oliver Stone ones, which I'm most familiar with. It's squarely a critique of the sort of the American imperialism. In Deer Hunter, there's not really, you very rarely, there's no politicians in it. You hardly even see any kind of higher command. There's no strategy. It's just the character. So it's more of a personal sort of character study than what it is having something to say about America's involvement in Vietnam. I think it's more of just war in general. I mean, it doesn't have the bloody hell. Someone just gave us £100 super chat. I've never seen that before. I'll come to that later. So I think it's that's amazing. For normal people, you think it isn't that political. But, you know, I think we'll touch on that a little bit later, but there's some people who will then politicize it and put all kinds of narratives into it, which aren't really there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could accuse me of doing that. I kind of have a knack for putting that first.
Yeah,
that's what our streams are all about. But I think that, like, the biggest critique of war and just war in general is that you're shown the rooted community in small town America, the authentic community. It's not like idyllic, but, you know, it's there. And what you can just think of what they show at the beginning. So Stevie's getting married. These guys, they're cornerstones of their community. Everyone is proud of them. And, you know, by going off to this war, it basically shatters this community. So Nikki never comes back. When Stevie comes back, he's just been married, but he's a double amputee. He has no legs. Michael comes back completely traumatized, and kind of the world that they had before, in which they're kind of in this blissful state where they have their spot in the world, and this is where everything is in place for them. Them going off to war, that shattered that ideal state they had.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's exactly what it is. It's about how they go through. That leads you into the third act as well. I mean, I'll just have a look at what that's. I have to say, like, thank you very much for that. That's amazing. But that's good stream, lads. Maybe a stupid question, but what's the significance behind deer hunting and Russian roulette in the film anyway? And why has Walton's character gone completely nuts by the end of it? I think he goes nuts because he's the most, and I have to say, like, thanks a lot. That's amazing. I hope you didn't make a mistake and put too many zeros in that. Like, but I think Walton's character, Nicky, is the most sort of sentimental and soft-hearted of them all. And it kind of just breaks his brain. And I think there's another take on that where he can't, normal life, you see this with soldiers in real life now with, that they've studied it more, but he can't, the sort of the dopamine and the normal grind of life after what he's been through, after the Russian roulette, I think it's affected him in certain ways where it's a kind of, he's been right to the edge, and then to go back from that go back to like normality and like the mundane job in the steel mill, it's not going to be enough anymore. He's really well and truly gone into the abyss there. And so he needs to get that edge back. And I think that he was most susceptible because he's like the most sort of sentimental or sensitive is the word that I'm looking for.
Sorry
and then,
about that.
And then the Russian roulette. So the Russian roulette angle on this, I think that's about the randomness of life. If we go back to De Niro's sort of one shot, kill or be killed, there is like a sort of where it's like this random thing where you can die or you can survive, and it's purely up to chance. That there isn't a sort of divine order in the world. You've just got to take your kind of what life throws at you. And I think that is also related to the deer hunting as well. So what you see towards the end of the movie is that the sort of the hand of God of De Niro wanting to kill the deer, he doesn't want to do it anymore. He kind of can't bring himself to just put the deer down. So I think there's a lot going on there. But I think the reason why he was so adamant to bring the Russian roulette aspect in is to say that it's just purely up to chance who lives and who dies. That it's a chaos. What would you say about all of this endeavor?
Well, I actually have a story from someone I know. I used to know. He's dead now, but there was an old Polish war veteran who I used to know, and I spoke to him when he was in his 90s. And what he said was that, you know, him surviving a war, it was all just up to chance. What he said was he doesn't know why he was the lucky one out of his family. Like his entire family died. Most of his family died. Then, you know, they either died during the war or a couple years later or illness. And it was just it was all really random. And he said there were several times that he thought himself he was about to die. And the words he said to me was that he doesn't know why out of his entire family, he was the lucky one. And I think that that's kind of what it's trying to say with the Russian roulette. It's completely a game of chance when it comes to war. So you get the idea that maybe, the guys that are going to win in the war are the big alpha Chads who have like the bulging muscles and there's the square jaws and they're going to lead their men into battle. But, you know, a lot of times who actually lives and dies in war is really up to chance because, you know, an artillery shell could hit you directly and incinerate you in one moment, or could hit the guy. It could, you know, maybe hit a couple meters away and kill the guy next to you. And really that is just a game of chance. And that's what Russian roulette really is. It's a 1 in 6 chance you're going to die. So completely random. There's no skill to it. There's no and has nothing to do with bravery or strength. It's purely just a game of chance. And that's kind of what the Russian roulette symbolizes, is that them kind of getting out of this war alive is it's completely out of their control. You know, so Nicky ends up, he never comes back. John Savage's character ends up a paraplegic, and Michael seems to be the lucky one who comes back in one piece, albeit mentally scarred. And it all really is just random and it's out of their control.
And it's Michael that starts off with the kind of ethic of as Coffee's Hunter says in the chat there, the one shot line directly links to the Russian roulette. So he actually has that mentality at the beginning of the movie. And you know, the one, he, if you look at the hunting scenes, you'll see that the De Niro sort of goes across the mountain, and he's got this rule where he's only allowed to fire one bullet. You've got to use one bullet and put it down, and then that's it. Whereas if you look at Stan and the others, they're just firing off their guns left, right, and center. They're screaming and shouting as they're going through across the mountain and through the woods. I mean, there's one scene where Stan pulls out his stupid little pistol thing and starts just randomly shooting at a deer, and the deer goes into the pond and it's sort of surrounded and trapped. And there's nothing noble at all about the way that they are going about hunting. There's no skill in it. You've got to do it with one shot. Otherwise, it's just it's disrespectful of the natural order. I think that's kind of what they're getting at there.
Yeah, in terms of the hunting scene, there's a famous scene, I guess this is what the movie's named after, is when De Niro has the deer right in his sights and he turns his rifle away and fires, letting the deer live. I actually was kind of struggling to think of something to say about that, but we were kind of talking about that before the stream. I guess I'll let you take that one.
About the deer?
Yeah, the deer that he doesn't shoot.
Yeah, I think it's because he's learned to have more of I think it's just a case that he's seen enough death. I don't think there's like that much in it. I think he's seen enough senseless death and slaughter, and he just doesn't want to kill the deer for that reason, because it's a thing of beauty. So I think that's kind of all there is to that particular scene there. He's had enough.
But what is interesting is a couple scenes later is when they're in the cabin in the mountain. So their hunting lodge where they stay and sleep when they go hunting on their trips. There's the three guys. There are three guys: John, Stan, and Axel. These guys were the three that didn't go to Vietnam. They stayed behind, and they're roasting each other. Axel says something about Stan's like girlfriend or something like that, and then Stan pulls out the little like revolver and says he's gonna blow Axel's brains out. And of course, he's not actually going to do it. It's kind of just guys messing around like they always do. But when Robert De Niro's character, Michael, comes in and sees Stan pointing the revolver at Axel, he's absolutely furious. And he even unloads all the bullets except for one, points it at Stan's head, and forces Stan to play a game of Russian roulette. And the other guys are just absolutely, they're just absolutely baffled by this. They're absolutely shocked. But with him, he's seen kind of the more harsh realities of the world, whereas these guys, they're still in the bliss of rural Pennsylvania, where they haven't seen Vietnam. And from the perspective of Michael, it's really just childishness. It's somebody, like I mentioned earlier, it's a child running with scissors. It's like the child playing with fire. They don't know the actual consequences of their actions.
Yeah, they're all like children. They don't understand. They don't see the world in this sort of existential way. They don't understand the gravity. He doesn't understand the gravity of what it is to wave a pistol in a man's face. And this also relates to the not killing the deer, whereas De Niro does. He's passed through that, and he's sort of overcome it. And so he's got nothing but contempt for these sort of plastic tough guys. And he literally says that to him as well. Like he says, like, you're some kind of big shot. And, he puts them through. He shows them what it is. He shows them what terror really is. And it's Stan just buckles and goes all to hell straight away.
Yeah. I another theme, though, that's interesting, because it's interesting what they do with what the film does with this, the idea of patriotism. So you can see the big contrast between the first act, the second, and then the third. So the first act, they're all, like the wedding celebration they have American flags draped everywhere. They have huge portraits of Michael, Nikki, and Steve on the wall. They have all the old World War II veterans there. They're toasting the guys, like, you can definitely tell that small town USA, they are extremely patriotic. And but then, when Michael goes off to war and he comes back, the entire town has a party planned for him. And I think John yells, "Let's hear it for the red, white, and blue." They have an American flag cake or something like that. And Michael sees that when he returns, he's just having none of it, because he's seen what going off to war actually entails. And he doesn't really feel like it's a fighting for your country or there's anything glorious to be proud of it when he goes at all. But, you know, I will say that I don't think that the film really is a critique of patriotism per se, because I don't think that the town, them kind of loving their town, loving America, I don't think that that's actually portrayed as a negative thing. I think it is a very healthy thing, but it's kind of a critique of patriotism being directed into the wrong end. So, you know, we saw this a lot in the last, we saw this a lot in the last 20 years, you know, of the fake George Bush era patriotism of, you know, we're going to bring freedom to Iraq or something like that. And I think though that what it's saying is that the patriotism and pride, it's not a bad thing. It's just that it's something that it can be very naive when it's going towards such a brutal cause like the Vietnam War, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, quid est veritas in the chat says the end scene is patriotism on their own terms. So on the end scene, they bury Nicky because he doesn't make it back. He can, you know, there's the famous scene where him and De Niro goes back to get Nicky, and they end up having a sort of one-to-one Russian roulette. And Nicky, he dies. He shoots himself in the head. His luck has run out. I mean, I will say I've got a criticism of that. The idea that Nicky has been there for like a year, and he's been playing. Let's just say, I did actually work this out when I watched it a few months ago with Lady Morgoth, and I was like, hold on a minute, like. The problem that I've got here is that let's just say Nicky plays this like game, this Russian roulette in the warehouse, like every Saturday night, and he's putting more bullets in the gun and he's playing it multiple times. I mean, he's only got like a one in six chance. Even if he was to do that once, one bullet once a week, like then logically, even with the best of luck, he would have 6 weeks and he would have shot himself. He cannot just go on doing that for like week after week after week. It's really, I'm not sure what the director's trying to say there. And then eventually, of course, yeah, his luck does run out when he faces Robert De Niro. So then they have the funeral scene. And at the end, the very end of the movie, they sing like "God Bless America" in the little pub where they go to, and it's like all of the characters have been through like hell, really. They've you know, they're all picking up the pieces of what the war's done to them, and it's kind of ambiguous. So the fella in the chat says it's patriotism on their terms, which is to say, like, yeah, it's not perfect. Maybe, you know, maybe the war was a big mistake, but it happened. And down on the level, down on the actual level of the lived life, we've got to kind of go on. We've still got to deal with it anyway. So it isn't so much a political statement as a personal one about these people just existing in the world.
Yeah, there's actually a debate among film critics of whether or not them singing "God Bless America" at the end is meant to be ironic or not. So is it meant to be like a criticism of America and American patriotism? But I actually am of the opinion that them singing "God Bless America" is meant to be genuine. They genuinely do love their country. They genuinely do love their town. And it's more them grieving for the loss of kind of the life that they had before the war. What, you know, with now with Nicky gone and Michael traumatized and Stephen now a amputee. It's more than like a grieving kind of the loss of the life that they had and the life that they loved. But, you know, I also think that, you know, that a lot of that scene, it's one that really got to me. I that doesn't happen to me a lot in movies, but yeah, it's one that really, it really hit home. It's difficult not to get choked up in that scene, especially when it's the part where John is in the kitchen cooking. And he's the one who starts singing when everyone else is waiting around the table. And because he's the joyful one. He's the one who is always laughing and having fun and is always full and so full of energy. And that he's the one who breaks down first and then starts singing. It really hits home.
It isn't ironic, because if it was ironic, they wouldn't have had all of that build up. It's just the sort of, It's a story of these five or six characters that we followed across probably about a 2 year time span, and you know, we like them, we know there's the little sort of love triangle that goes on. And the another thing is that the end of the movie is like really, really long as well, which is unusual for movies to have a really long third act. They usually wrap it up and sort of give you some kind of catharsis. But you can see that the director really wanted us to focus on the aftermath of all of this. And so the overall effect is that you get this kind of bittersweet story of like how this has affected these people's lives, and that they are still patriotic despite it all. I don't think it's ironic, because they wouldn't have spent that they wouldn't have built it up with the kind of the awkward scene where, you know, they've just buried Nikki and nobody really knows. That somebody's like talking about the weather and it's always really great today. And like as I get older, the amount of funerals and things like that I've been to seems to increase by the year. And it is like that. It is really awkward when nobody really knows what to say. So that wasn't played for like irony. That was for real. If you were going to do it ironically, you wouldn't have put that amount of emotion and thought into the whole scene.
Yeah, I must say about Meryl Streep's character is like, the other thing is that it's with De Niro in real life. She is just an insufferable shitlib. But I really liked her character too. You know, she just kind of had this. She just has this kind of goodness to her. The girl who works down at the corner store, who everyone knows, and they buy their milk and eggs from. And she was beautiful back then, I must say. It's a shame that she's not like that in real life.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, because I had in my notes that when you look at war movies, each kind of genre of war movie has its own like aesthetics and its own kind of feel. And the Deer Hunter, I think it was quite influential in that with the Vietnam War movies. But and it's like you see the, and I know it seems like an obvious point, but it's interesting to just kind of mull it over that. We now think of, say, the jungles and fire in the jungle, these kind of bamboo cages, the river, people like the men in the black pajamas. Like, it's all got this kind of Vietnamese. There's a special Vietnam feel to it. And, you know, you see, it's also like American soldiers where they don't have their shoes on and rats, and it's very sweaty. And then, you know, World War II's got lots of different sort of aesthetics, with usually, and this will be in documentaries as well, but usually it'll be the Eastern Front is the darkest of them. You know, well, let's not get carried away on that one, on like me cozy afternoon movie stream. But you know what I mean? I think Full Metal Jacket is a little bit different. It's more, there's more concrete in Full Metal Jacket. But I do think that's an interesting thing. The Gulf War is all high tech. It's all about looking at these kind of computer images, the heat sensor, the missile strikes, and all of this. So each of the different wars, as depicted through movies and documentaries, they've all got their different look and feel. I just think it's an interesting thing to note.
Yeah, I actually did think that an interesting concept for a film that will never in a million years be made would be a film kind of like this, revolving around World War II era America, kind of like a film about guys in a working class town going off to fight in World War II, and then kind of their communities being devastated by them not coming home. That's never going to get made for obvious reasons. But like, one thing that people often forget is that people think of Vietnam as they think of the stick thin 19-year-old boy with the thick frame glasses being sent off to some war by some cruel general with gray hair and a crew cut who, you know, has an American flag tattooed on his right bicep or something like that, and that he goes there and gets killed and stuff. But then the image of the American soldier from World War II is some, you know, square jawed guy with like bright blue eyes going off there and then just like mowing down a bunch of German soldiers or something like that, like, you know, Saving Private Ryan. My goodness, that one's awful. But what people have to remember is that with World War II, there was just as much conscription, actually even more. World War II had much more conscription than the Vietnam War did in the United States. There was, of the proportion of the army that was conscripted versus volunteer, Vietnam had a lot more volunteers than World War II did for America. And, you know, it's interesting that we I think everyone knows why, but you'll never get that interpretation of a history. You'll never get the same messages and the same image based on how the historical narrative has been presented to us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just to sort of switch gears on this slightly. So one of the things that we've been seeing here is that it was it's a character study. It's not that political, and it's not you feel for the characters and you get into their stories within this, and that's why it's got like a bit of an emotional impact. Now, when we say, well, it wasn't very political, other people at the time had their own view on that. Just to sort of get into what it says on the Wikipedia article before I move on here, and he says, however, the Deer Hunter was not without critical backlash. By the way, don't even bother going to Wikipedia. Like, Pauline Kael of The New Yorker wrote a positive review with some reservations. A small-minded film with greatness in it, with an enraptured view of common life, but enraging because despite its ambitiousness and scale, it has no more moral intelligence than the Eastwood action pictures. Because it turns out Cimino, who made Deer Hunter, was involved with the Dirty Harry movies, which we covered as well. Andrew Saris wrote that the film was massively vague, tediously epileptical, and mysteriously hysterical. It is perhaps significant that the actors remain more interesting than the characters they play. And Jonathan Rosenbaum, of course, the Deer Hunter, he says, the Deer Hunter as an Oscar-leading weepy about macho buddies and a disgusting account of what the evil Vietnamese did to poor, innocent Americans. John Simon of The New York wrote, for all its pretensions to something newer and better, this film is only an extension of the old Hollywood war movie lie. The enemy is still bestial and stupid and no match for our purity and heroism. Only we no longer wipe up the floor with him, rather we litter it with his guts. In a review of The Deer Hunter for Chicago Magazine, Studs Terkel, that's a name and a half, like Studs Terkel, wrote that he was appalled by its shameless dishonesty, and that not since the birth of a nation has a non-Caucasian people been portrayed in so barbaric fashion. Cimino's dishonesty was to project a sadistic psyche not only onto Charlie, but to all the Vietnamese portrayed. And another one says, it's a sort of feminist kind of, the feminists were quite happy with how Meryl Streep did this. But the worst was somebody called Peter Biskind, who wrote a long and famous article. And he basically just said, like, this is extreme fascist propaganda. So what I'm getting at here is that it's interesting because to sort of normal people like us, we're going to say, well, it's not really, it isn't political. It doesn't have a political message. It's just following these characters. But you can see that certain sections of the intelligentsia, let's say, they make it political because they then say, well, it's got all of these archetypes and all of these narratives in it about how the Vietnamese are portrayed, about our heroic white boys going off to fight the war and all of this. But Peter Biskind's article like really goes all out, and he says, like, so I mean it's interesting because I think he might be right. But what he's talking about, he brings up the scene with De Niro in the mountains. Like, so if anybody's seen that sort of picture that goes around by Caspar David Friedrich, where it's supposed to be like Nietzsche, but he's on a mountain and he's looking across into the, you know, it's like this Faustian man thing. He's looking into the sky, standing on top of the mountains. So Peter Biskin's take on this was like De Niro is like the Ubermensch, and that they've got all of these scenes in it where he's to the heavenly choirs of the Russian. I mean, they are really powerful scenes where he's all alone, like going across the mountains, you know, like the sort of the Faustian archetype, all by himself. And then he's being serenaded by Russian monks doing Gregorian chant. And it's this particular fella, this lib in the New Yorker and these people, they're saying this is like pure German romanticism and fascist propaganda, like out and out. I just think it's so they are making it political. You can say, oh, well, there's nothing political in it. It's just a good movie with a lot of interesting themes and characters. But the intelligentsia will make it political, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, a great quote in the chat. The liberal critic cries out in pain as he strikes you.
Yeah, it is. It really is like that. They'll not leave you alone with your movie. They will politicize it. You can make good characters, nice setting, you know, just drift away, switch off the politics, but they will politicize it.
But here's that. I actually had a lot to say about that because, you know, for me, of course, I wasn't alive back then, but in comparison to things like, oh, I don't know, some shit lib song by John Lennon singing about, I don't know, Happy Christmas or something like that, or, you know, some awful hippie with some glasses. This movie definitely, of all the stuff that came out of the era, this is the best anti-war piece of art that I've ever seen from the Vietnam era. But, you know, the left apparently in this era was supposed to be the ones who were anti-war. They were the ones against the horrific crime of this horrible war. But, you know, I think that this really hammers home just how cynical the left-wing anti-war movement of the era was. Because, you see, they're not outraged at the fact that because, you see, what they're outraged at is not the fact that it portrayed the war as a worthy cause and that, you know, Americans should go off and fight in it. It's actually the complete opposite. Like I mentioned earlier, it's saying that they shouldn't go off and fight because they should be, you know, at home in their town and working in their steel mill with their wives and their families. But I think, though, that what this really shows is that the anti-war leftist movement of the era wasn't humanitarian at all. It was really just using war as a moral indictment against white America in order to bring about the social changes which followed that era and the new ideology which we're now living in the full brunt of. So, like, I don't think any of these critics care the least about some, you know, villager in Vietnam hit by a flamethrower or something like that. They just simply hate the United States. They simply hate white people. They hate white Americans, and they want to use anything they can as this moral indictment against them. And just the image of showing them in their own home as good people, whereas, you know, going off to Vietnam, showing the Vietnamese as anything other than, you know, the most kindly of people in the world, that's kind of what set the critics off so much. So I think that just the thing you got to take away from that is that the leftist anti-war movement, it never was about, you know, saving lives. It never was about, you know, the horrors of war. It was all political. It was all just meant to use the war, among other things, as just another way to guilt us and to bash us over the head for how evil we were. And, you know, I think I just look back at a lot of that stuff, and it really is quite disgusting. Like, I don't believe that any of it was really genuine. I don't think that it was motivated by a genuine wish to preserve human lives.
Yeah, I mean, what I'd say on this, the sort of the liberals in the places like the New Yorker and whatnot, like they aren't interested in, they're not sort of on the side of the Vietnamese because they're communists or something like that. That's kind of like that would be a sort of, you know, conservative kind of take, is that, oh, they're on the side of the communists. It isn't like that. What their problem is, the what they would call the othering, the that that the I mean, in the case of the deer hunter, like they are othered. There's what the Biskind article talks about, how in all of these movies, in whenever the Vietnamese are portrayed, it's just like they scream this gibberish in there's, and then they won't even put subtitles under or anything. So it's just supposed to be this very foreign entity which is threatening the sort of the good old boys from back home. And but what's really got that knickers in a twist here, which when I was kind of reading, like sort of thinking this through, is that it's a raw appeal to emotion that they don't like, and it makes them very, very worried. And the reason for this is that the left use, like, I think it's like the front part of the brain, and you'll see almost all left-wing intellectualism, it's just a clever word game. It's just playing around with terminology and things like that. Whereas what they are saying is that, you know, when the left they call out fascism, they're not really always going, but the more sophisticated of them, they're not just talking about the 1930s. What they're talking about is when patriotism and the right are tapping into the sort of lizard brain of the masses to get them into this big, like, emotional state to just go on their raw urges and raw emotions. And whereas the left are always kind of thinking in terms of dialectics and discourse and how people frame things and use words. And what worries them and what they really don't like is that the sort of, if left unchecked, this idea that what the fascists are up to, this appeal to the emotions, will just overwhelm all their clever little mind games, that it doesn't matter anymore. I mean, an example of this is like, you know, the thing about the let's say, like, eating maggots, which is the thing now, and the way they deconstruct things. And so people will say, well, it's not normal that we eat maggots. Like, it's disgusting. And this will be with us within a year, just watch. And then they'll say, but why? What is the difference between that source of protein and a piece of meat? And what's left is that you're left to say, well, it's just the way we've always done things. But what, in actual fact, like, that's not a good enough reason for them. So they've kind of got you there. Because in you know, it doesn't really matter what this, if it's maggots or beef, they would argue. It's just that you've got these priors, you've got these preconceptions of how things are, and they're not based on anything rational. So that kind of narrative is cut away from under you when you find that you've got nothing there to reach for. And the answer to all of this is what we see now is like the yes meme. It's just, yeah, it is the way it is, and that's the way we like it, and we don't care if it's rash. So that this is like the right-wing response, which is kind of fascistic, if you know what I mean, because it's just going to say, well, yeah, we don't care. Not everything has to make sense in this purely rationalistic way.
The other thing I noticed in that article that you sent me was the way that, you know, people like this guy, and we all know who he is, The way that they kind of just build, like, the way that they build narratives is the exact same way as they do it today. So he points out in the article the My La massacre, and then the one photo of the South Vietnamese general shooting the other North Vietnamese militant in the head. And what you have to imagine happened back then was when they got that photo, they plastered it in all the newspapers everywhere. They made it world famous. And then, you know, when My La happened, I'm sure the exact same people did the exact same thing, and they just built this huge narrative around just these two really small events. But then, of course, you know, they're not going to put in the paper all the what the North Vietnamese did. But, you know, I'm not a liberal, so I can fully understand that, you know, the North Vietnamese are defending their land, and of course, you know, they're probably not going to be treating you with kid gloves, and that's kind of just the reality of the world. So I didn't come away from the film thinking less of Vietnamese people, because I just understand they're in a brutal war, and this is probably how what it was like for an American guy. I mean, if you're a American lad in the 70s, and, you know, they have the famous saying that when the forest starts speaking Vietnamese, these guys probably were something that was completely foreign to you. you wouldn't understand a word they were saying. They would have been, you wouldn't have understood their way of life or anything about them. It was something that was fundamentally foreign. And I think that that's what The Deer Hunter does very well. It portrays the Vietnamese as something that is completely different, and that the American guys in the jungle, they're way out of place. You know, when they're in the mountains in Pennsylvania, they're exactly in place. They're in their spot in the world. When they're in Vietnam, they're completely out of their spot in the world. And the other thing is to point out is just that they talk about the othering. You'll never see them say this about even the one critic even mentioned that a non-Caucasian people. Well, you'll never see them say this about Saving Private Ryan. Like, there is that brilliant video by that normie guy on YouTube of him dissecting Saving Private Ryan. He made a video called Killing Private Kraut, and I remember that you wrote a blog post about that a couple of years back. And you just see the contrast is that they'll be absolutely outraged at this kind of portrayal of any non-white group, but then when it comes to like Germans, for example, in World War One, it's a complete reversal. Whereas dehumanization is Saving Private Ryan goes way, way further in dehumanizing the Germans than The Deer Hunter goes in demonizing the Vietnamese. Like, I don't think I never feel that the guys get pleasure out of killing in the movie. Actually, quite the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, somebody in the chat says we shouldn't be defending the Vietnam War. I'm certainly not defending it. I think it was a disaster from start to finish, and the Americans shouldn't have been there. But when after the fact, how it affects people's lives, regardless of the why we were there, it is what it is. It's as De Niro would say, this is this. It's kind of you can't undo the past, and you've got to live with it. And I think that's why. That you've got that bittersweet bit at the end. But, you know, it is the case of patriotism being misused to direct energies into places where they shouldn't be going. This is a big, big problem. And it's why, in a way, if you sort of the libtard criticisms in The New Yorker end up being sort of valid, because he can say, this kind of nostalgic, overly emotional portrayal, it will lead to this happening again. And in fact, in the 80s, you'd get the Oliver Stone, he's really far left, and he was like, his movies are really political as well. But as I mentioned to Frody, what you see with things like First Blood and Rambo, and then a lot of Stallone movies, is almost like a justification for more war. It because First Blood starts out kind of feeling and looking really similar to The Deer Hunter, the traumatized vets and all of that. By the time you get to Rambo 3, it's a celebration of the brave warriors of Afghanistan and the Mujahideen.
Yeah, and talk about like history repeating itself. We went through the entire the 2000s was all, everything was just pro-war. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson actually did a great podcast on this. And then that's kind of what I thought of when I was watching this movie about kind of the left's anti-war movement in the 70s. But then, you know, how they were other than this one era. And like I said, they were only anti-war because they could use the war as kind of this political football. They've always been the most pro-war. Now, I mean, I guess you could say it was like the neocon, right? Which we don't really even consider to be that conservative, but you got to understand the early 2000s, everything was pro-war. It was always like, you know, the military is the greatest thing in the world. It's our boys going off to spread freedom and, like, I don't know, make it so that Afghan women can go on slut walks or something like that, or to legalize homosexuality in Iraq or something like that. I really do like the memes that we've created out of this, but yeah, go ahead.
One thing I'll say on this, you know, I know it's like all the mode now in sort of the dissident right, the internet right wing circles. I know it's all the fashion to just sort of slag off populism, and I'm guilty of that as well. You know, you get black pilled. It's the elites are never gonna, you're never gonna get into power. You'll just be shut down. All of this kind of thing. But what I will say for like the populism of the last few years or so, the last 5 years in the West, is that we do see that increasingly the foreign policy, which would include the Forever Wars, is being increasingly sort of lumped over onto the left side of the political discourse. And that's actually where it belongs, because it's their values that are universal. It's they are the most sort of hooked up to the whole sort of global homo project and globalization and all of that. But where it was in, say, the 2000s is that the left got all of the trendy social justice causes, but then like the patriotism on the right would be kind of outsourced. Like that would then get the discourse on having wars in the Middle East. So if populism's done nothing else in recent years, it has at least gone some way to kind of shift that over onto the left side of the spectrum where it belongs, because that's the system. That's the morality of the system. And they have to own that. So if they want to have another war in Syria or have a war with Russia, Hillary Clinton wanted to have a war with Russia, if that's where they want to go, then they can take ownership of that and don't talk about like warmongering on the right, because it's just this convenient get out where they get all of the sort where, you know, they never have to get their hands dirty. And it's lumped in with people who've got no business supporting wars and bombing other people's countries. I've got nothing against these people in their countries. Leave them alone.
Yeah, I'm very much the same. You know, one thing that I made a meme a couple weeks ago, that there was the meme from the 2000s of the eagle in front of the American flag saying, "Looks like you could use some freedom in Iraq." Well, now it's the eagle with like the problematic glasses in front of the LGBT flag saying, "Looks like you could use some diversity in your country over there." And that is a very good development on our part. You know, I've said on Twitter before that I think probably the greatest frame game in history is essentially what the American media has done and the American ruling class has done is it's pushed all of the hatred that America gathers around the world based on their foreign policy and on their behavior onto their enemies. So through like a lot of the movies, you know, from this era and ever since, the American war hawk, the thing that's always portrayed is that it's the white straight, it's the straight white male patriarchy, it's WASP America who's, you know, going off and destroying these other countries, who's, you know, leveling Iraq or something like that, or, you know, Vietnam in this case. And that they've kind of successfully made it so that the left can clean up when it comes to the moral points on being against this war, but at the same time, it's their agenda that's being advanced by this war. It's one arm of the empire doing the work for the other arm, and then the blame ends up being thrown into the lap of the greatest enemy of the regime, that being, you know, the traditional WASP white America. Yeah, and I think that one of the best developments of the last few years is what you mentioned, that the left is now having to own the fact that going off to fight in a war in Iraq so that, you know, you can, I don't know, make sure that they have drag queen story hour in their public libraries too. Well, that is a left wing imperative, and all these wars, all this bombing and stuff, it is globalism being brought in. It's not conservative. It's not right wing.
Yeah.
And it's really nothing. It has nothing to do with anything that we would be standing up for.
Yeah, and it's good to see. I mean, I saw a meme on Telegram or something yesterday, I think it was, and it had all of these coffins. I don't know where they'd come back from, maybe Iraq in the 2000s, but there was a lot of, it was like 100 coffins of American soldiers, and they were all sort of adorned in the Star Spangled Banner, you know, when they've got the American flag and they're coming off the big aeroplanes, the carrier aeroplanes come back. And then somebody said, I think it was Genie or somebody, and said, like, you know, this time next year, all of these flags will be the rainbow ones. Or it could have been what an actual shitlib on Twitter or somewhere said. But I thought, yeah, like that, yeah. So that's exactly how it should be. Because what it'll do, we'll get all of these white boys the hell out of the military, and it'll put let them do it. They want to do it anyway. And that's what they're fighting for. They're not fighting for some kind of classic liberal Americanism or classic patriotism or, you know, liberating people. They're fighting for that rainbow flag or, you know, other things as well, which you can't even talk about on YouTube. So if yeah, do it then. When you bring the boys back, put those rainbow flags over them, and let's dispense with the bullshit that it's patriotism that wants to go off and fight wars. I mean, you can see it right now with the discourse around China, about the way they talk about China. It's the same thing. It's just like, is China going to be like a supersized Vietnam?
I don't think that they're going to, I don't think that's going to go very well for them. I had another meme that I made, which it was an image of a, the top of a Starbucks building that had the rainbow flag. So it was the Starbucks, like a big 3D Starbucks logo with the rainbow flag on the top. And I said, this is how you know when you've been conquered by the American Empire, when these things start to show up in your neighborhood. That's the symbol of conquest, really. You know, it is just interesting, the symbology of that, you know, now there's troops that are marching with it. Like I saw an image of Marines marching with a transgender flag. And, you know, that is kind of like become the flag of the enemy. It's the flag of global homo now. Someone put in the chat that Steve Blinken now ordered the rainbow flags to go up at all the embassies permanently. And they might as well just take down the U.S. flag and replace it with that, because the narratives coming out of the zeitgeist today is that the U.S. flag is just a horrible, evil, racist symbol, and that American history is all illegitimate because of racism. So why not just replace it with the rainbow flag, at least to be honest?
Yeah, I mean, Ashen Duke puts in the chat there, hey, can just imagine the Westboro Baptist Church protesting those rainbow flag clad coffins. Yeah, and it's kind of true, because you will get the sort of patriotard types who would say this is like this horrible insult, and it is. But you see, it is an insult that they're coming back in those rainbow coffins. But the thing is, that's what they were fighting for. Like, that's actually what they were fighting for. They're not fighting for any kind of what they would think of as the Americanism. I mean, if just to touch base with the deer hunter in the town there, one of the reasons why it seems so authentic is because it is traditional. I mean, they're obviously a very religious people, but it doesn't have all of this kind of neoliberal garbage just swamping their town. It's like, you know, the guy who owns his own bar, there's the local, I think he looks more like an Italian fella, has got the local supermarket. They're not part of these giant mega corporations. And obviously, the heavy industry of the steel mill itself, was all of this stuff was wiped out in the 80s. So this whole way of life, which actually created the people and the patriotism of that time, it all got wiped out by what is now being exported around the world.
Yeah, and I guess like the ultimate anti-war movie message of the movie is that is it worth it, and is it worth, you know, giving that away for this cause, which you know, as we're seeing today, it clearly it's a cause that's designed to dissolve the very things that make these people patriotic to begin with. The question is it worth it? And I think ultimately, and the answer is no.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if I've got much left to say. I'll have a look at the chat. The irony when they talk about diversity is they actually want to make every person and every possible. Yeah, everything will be the same. It's a homogenizing force. And the kind of in Deer Hunter, it's like the politics is so far in the background that it is just sort of, they'll just do what their country wants. And that's a big problem when that gets lumped in this case, white America. So that gets you back to what that, you know, that libtard was saying in the New York, the New Yorker or whatever it was. So, you know, they are like saying that they're being manipulated through raw feelings to go off and do these wars. Like there is some truth to that. I mean, I'll also say that take note as well of what their deepest fear is. Again, like it isn't that these word games and all of this terminology. I like the idea of these leftist mind tricks. You can see that the people, so many of the left-wing intellectuals are like, they've got like a very high verbal IQ, you know, and so this is how they craft all this stuff. And I it does appeal to me, the idea that you can just step over that entirely and not take any notice of it and go with your gut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing that, like, the contrast to the present day is, like, the article has to mention the one photo of the guy, the South Vietnamese guy shooting the other, and then My Lai. I mean, in contrast to the present day, what you're going to get is every single article about BLM, it's going to mention George Floyd or something like that. So they just kind of get there. one like example of this, and then they just spread that across the world. And that's kind of how they get people to go along with these narratives.
Yeah, George Floyd's photo is the version of that now, because the othering, as they would have it, has just been turned on white people, not just white Americans, but white people everywhere. We become the other. You know, I mean, you can go back and you can see the enemies of liberalism across the decades. And right now, you know, it's literally an image of a white family walking on the beach or something like that. Like that is now the version of the Islamic extremists in the 2000s or the Soviet Union. They always have the other. No, liberalism always needs an other to define itself against.
Yeah, I guess I just say to the libtard in the New York Times, apply that logic consistently. So, you know, just what you're saying about kind of the othering and the getting people to go off to war. Sure, that might be true, but just try applying that to other events in history, you know, both recent and further back and the present day. And, you know, they might come out with a different opinion on some of those.
Yeah, so I'm happy to wrap up. Have you got any ideas about what we want to get into next time?
Yeah, for our next stream, I wanted to talk about Around the World in 80 Days. It's a feel-good movie. It's really a quintessentially British movie, and it's really fun. A lot to talk about with that one. You know, it's not nearly as sad as The Deer Hunter. And you know, maybe we'll instead of having kind of one that's a bit of a downer, this one will be a bit of an upper. So, but I know, other than that, I enjoyed this one. I think we did it justice.
So I would also just plug my Morgcast, which is on Odyssey, which I'll slip into the comments there. Where I do I'm talking just me going through one of the World Economic Forum's articles on the Internet of Bodies, which is this big new thing that they're pushing, which, because I hate technology and I just hate to see the world getting more and more technological. The town that they live in, that's like with 1972, that's kind of like, that would be fine for me. There's no mobile phones. They didn't have an internet. Everything seems authentic, but I am where I am, raging against the world on the internet and looking at modern movies as a kind of escapism. So I tell you what, like, thanks again for that amazing super chat. Thanks for watching the stream, everybody. I'm just looking at the chat here. I hope you've enjoyed it. Check out me Morgcast on Odyssey, and I'll see you later. Thanks for listening, folks.